I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one's about the geography of economic recovery, but don't let that scare you. It's Juan Enriquez's original riff on jobs and money as a function of zip code concentrations of brain cells and emerging new life science industries. Juan Enriquez is an investor, teacher, writer, sometime politician. He's famous now on YouTube for riffs like this one. In fact, we're picking up on a TED Talk that he gave this spring at the Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference in California. At TED, Juan Enriquez pictured a sort of race underway between the crashing of auto companies and newspapers and other branded industries and the simultaneous blooming of super tech invention. Things like the big dog carry-all robot, or implantable organs, and shoe leather man-made without cows. At the moment General Motors went down, I asked Juan Enriquez in his Boston office tower for a sort of scorecard. Juan Enriquez, bring people up to date on the TED Talk that a lot of folk have seen about the race between technology and the distress in this economy. What's the score in June 2009?
Look, I'm really scared, not because I don't think this government is well intentioned, not because the people in it aren't smart. These are good people, and they're people who, for the most part, I think, you know, are people that you and I would be happy to have lunch with.
People you were happy to vote for or not?
You know, I'm an independent, and I don't talk about my politics because I vote by individual rather than by party. I want to see what people do as opposed to what a platform that usually isn't followed is about. I can tell you that I was happy to see a transition. And in that context, I think what matters in this stuff is we really have to pay attention to some of the big trends. And I'm very scared that these folks aren't doing it. About 85% of the total budget of the United States is mandated. And we're going to end up paying about 46 cents of every dollar that goes out in this budget over the next couple of years in interest rates. And what that's telling you is that's money that's going to pay previous debts or debts that we're accumulating today. It's not going to build new stuff that's going to allow us to pay off debt. And there comes a point where you stack enough debt that you and I can't pay off a credit card, we can't pay off a house, we can't pay off a mortgage. And we're darn close to putting the United States into that situation. Most of that debt was built first under Reagan, then under the first Bush, and then on a massive scale under the policies that led to these bailouts from the last Bush administration. Having said that, boy, is there enough co-responsibility and crimes on both sides. I mean, I think both sides have been spending money like there's no tomorrow, and the debt that is built up in this country is now about 404% of what we make in a year by the time you take our private debt, our government debt, and business debt. And that means that the country as a whole is leveraged up the wazoo, and we are going to start paying for that. It's not our kids that are going to start paying for that. See, we thought we were being really smart, and our kids would pay for it, and it's their problem. 80-some-odd percent of the debt is now mandated. If we don't take on serious reforms of Social Security, of capping medical spending at about 18% of GDP, of controlling military spending, and of reducing interest rate payments, none of the rest of it matters. The bridges to Alaska don't matter. The overfunded airports don't matter. The, you know, special congressional whatever, all that stuff has to be taken care of, but that's peanuts. It's the four big programs that you really have to go after. And if we don't go after them, and if we don't go after them on a bipartisan basis, and if we don't show the rest of the world, which now owns most of our debt, or the majority of our debt, not most of it, that we're actually serious about putting our financial house in order. And again, that doesn't mean paying off all our debts tomorrow. It simply means there has to be an inflection point where year by year by year the debt goes up as a percentage of this economy. That's got to start coming down. And to do that, two things have to happen. One is we have to take on the big four interest payments, which means debt, military, medical spending, and Social Security. And the other thing that has to happen is we have to find ways of really growing this economy and jobs. And that's the high-tech bits. That's not bailing out Detroit. That's not Chrysler. Chrysler's not going to double the U.S. GNP. But the stuff coming out of Silicon Valley, the stuff coming out of Cambridge, Mass., the stuff coming out of Austin, Texas, the stuff coming out of Chicago, the stuff coming out of Maryland, that conceivably could double the U.S. economy. And we've really got to focus on that stuff.
Spell out your hopes. I mean, pick some winners here. Introduce a few of the companies, ideas, industries, technologies that could get us out of this hole.
Look, one of the reasons why I spend most of my time in venture capital is because every day here is like Christmas. I mean, it really is. It's just incredible because in the morning you come in and you read the science journals and people have done stuff that you just couldn't have conceived that people would be able to do. It's just absolutely extraordinary what people are doing. I saw a video yesterday of a kid who had the equivalent of, you know, when you're deaf, you have a cochlear implant that goes inside your skull and allows you to hear. This is the equivalent of a brainwave implant that goes inside your skull but above the brain. It doesn't go inside the brain. And it reads your brainwaves. And in essence, they're teaching these kids to look at a computer screen and say, move the cursor here, move it there, move it at this speed, move it at that speed. And the kids have gotten good enough at this stuff that within a few minutes, they can start playing a game called Space Invaders and shoot at the aliens and move the little tank forward and back and say, shoot. And that just gives you enormous hope for people who are paraplegic, for people who've had strokes, for people who need to move artificial limbs. I mean, that company and 200 other companies come into this office every day through journals or through business presentations, and I have never seen a better time to invest. Things are cheap. There's a lot of smart people. There's a lot of technology that we've been investing in for 15, 20 years in life sciences that is incredibly exciting right now. And Boston is the center of the universe for that stuff. Per capita, there isn't a smarter place than Boston right now. And that just makes this a really interesting place to be sitting and watching this stuff and investing in it.
Hmm. Spell out a few of the other kinds of technologies that we haven't heard about yet.
One thing that there's a couple of things that I think are going to be very big. One idea comes to me from a very smart guy called Pal Safo, who sits out in California. We've been expecting robots to be important for a long time. Mm. And, you know, we all grew up with Lost in Space, and we all grew up with the Jetsons and Rosie, the robot who did everything, and everybody else. But robots have been really stupid. Okay, I mean, a smart robot today is a Roomba. And still people get really attached to those Roombas. Okay, most people, a majority of people, have named their Roombas and treat it almost like a pet. About a third of people start traveling with Roombas, taking them along on vacations, which is very strange. As you're getting into more empathetic robots, some of the stuff being built over at the Media Lab that seem to react to people, it's close, you're seeing it in toys, but it isn't there yet, right? I mean, you haven't seen a robot yet that people kind of go, wow, would that pass a Turing test, which is, you know, Turing test in computers,
sure.
If you've got a wall, you can't tell if the person on the other side of the wall is a person or a computer.
Right.
Nowhere close on robots. Is that an animal or is it a robot? Except that robots, like computers, are doubling and doubling and doubling in processing power every 18 months. And seemingly out of nowhere, over the course of 3 or 4 years, we're going to go from robots that have the intelligence of an earthworm to robots that have the intelligence of a lower mammal. And boy, is that going to be a change. And you're starting to see it. There's a Boston company called Boston Dynamics that's built something called Big Dog that people look at it and they kind of go, wow, that's a headless horse. And it's getting close. It's not there yet. But over the next 3 or 4 years, seemingly out of nowhere, that's going to be a very large industry. Life sciences has 15, 20, 30 different offshoots that are fundamentally going to change how we make energy, how we make chemicals, how we make textiles, how we make food, how we make drinks, how we process information, how we store information, where real estate works, where people settle. It's just such a large industry, because what we're doing is we're moving from simply coding in ones and zeros into coding in the language of life, which is the four letters of DNA. And as we move from reading life in the human genome into writing life in the form of being able to build very large programs, artificial chromosomes that program cells, which is something that Synthetic Genomics, a California company, is doing, that is going to be a massive change in the economy. As we begin to understand tissue engineering and how to regrow our own tissues, which, by the way, we do every day, right? Every day we're growing bone, every day we're growing skin, every day we're growing gut. But we're now learning how to regrow, at Tony Atala's lab in Wake Forest, ears, bladders. We're beginning to learn how to regrow tracheas. We're beginning to learn how to... That stuff is coming, and it's coming very fast. And the first impact is going to be in places like the fashion industry and the ag industry and textile production and leather production and things like that, where we'll be able to grow leather for belts or for shoes or for jackets without having to make the cow. We'll simply clone the skin. And if you want to get cute about it, we'll clone the skin in dishes that are already in the shape of what you want to have. So the outline of the belt will be in there and it'll simply grow in that form, or the outline of the shoe. You know, this is really going to change a lot of very interesting things.
If this were the NBA finals, what would the score be in between the crashing economy and the booming technology?
Well, look, one of the things that to my mind is scary is in the 1960s, if you looked at the global economy or the U.S. economy, about a third was agriculture, a third was manufacturing, a third was services. And what that meant is you could be very prosperous in North Dakota, you could be very prosperous in Detroit, and you could be very prosperous in Cambridge, Mass. What's happened today is about 70 to 75% of the global economy, and probably more of the U.S. economy, is knowledge and services. And that means it's really hard for you if you don't have a college degree. And if you don't understand that, and there was a poll taken in Michigan about 5 years ago that told you that 60-some-odd percent of the workers in the auto plants saw no reason for their kids to go to college. If you don't get that transition, you can be in real trouble, because agriculture is now about 4% of the global economy, and we're subsidizing it every day, all of us. Manufacturing is about the same size, but it's moved offshore. So it's moved to Japan and then Korea and then India and China. And knowledge is what's been growing. Now, the problem with knowledge is it doesn't grow geographically on a spread basis. It means that some zip codes in the U.S. are incredibly smart, and some zip codes in the U.S. simply are not attracting the kinds of companies that it takes to build a knowledge economy. And what that means is, because this stuff is so powerful, because it grows so fast, you have a huge differential in wealth creation in some places and not in others. And as I look at this crisis, it's going to accentuate and lead to some horrifying consequences in places that didn't build a knowledge economy that depended on 100-year-old industries. At the same time, some other areas are going to be just thriving. Now, one temptation is to say, all right, we'll take all the money out of the areas that are thriving and keep the old stuff. Or we'll indebt all of us and try and keep the old stuff. That is a very dangerous thing to do.
We don't talk about red states and blue states anymore in the Obama world. Should we talk about the untied states of America anymore?
Look, I mean, I asked a ludicrous question when I published this book 5 years ago, and the question was, how many stars will be in the U.S. flag in 50 years? And the reason I thought it was a reasonable question to ask, first, is because there's never been a U.S. president who's been buried under the same flag he was born under. So assuming continuity is a dangerous thing. The second reason is because the U.S. trend line has been for the country to get larger and larger. And there's a perfectly reasonable way of getting to 55 stars or maybe even 60. And that will not be unusual given a U.S. history. However, one of the things we should also look at is what happened to Britain when it was in the U.S. situation about this time last century, two centuries ago in the 1900s. And that is, it was the most powerful country in the world by far. It was a reserve currency. It had the best universities. It had the best manufacturing. It had the best army. And nobody competed with it. And that country, in the space of, less than 50 years, went from 12 million square miles into about 89,000 square miles. And even today, the British Isles is breaking up into Scotland and Wales and England. And that's not just happening in Britain. It's also happening in France with Corsica and Normandy. It's happening in Spain with Galicia, Catalonia, and the Basque homelands. It's happening in northern Italy. It's happening in the Belgian area. It's happening in Netherlands. It's happening in parts of Austria. It's happening in parts of Finland. It's actually very hard to find parts of the world where people aren't talking about having more autonomy. In recent times, you've now had the governor of Texas running potentially on a more autonomous Texas. You've had governors elected in Alaska on the Alaska Independence Platform. You've had people running in Hawaii on the same platform. And if we aren't careful about how we treat each other, and if we aren't careful about stopping this us versus them mentality, there might come a point where some people decide those people over there really are baby killers or godless people or whatever you want to call them on the other side. And this country shouldn't divide up into the Rush Limbaughs and the Howard Sterns, because most of us are somewhere in the middle of that. And I don't think we want to be governed by either of those groups.
You've made some astonishingly chauvinistic claims for Boston in the New World as the not only the smartest place on earth, but therefore approaching a completely new sort of boom and importance to everybody. There was a time when Boston thought of itself not only as the hub of the universe, but as the Paris of the 19th century. Tell us about this new 21st century Boston.
Well, you know, half facetiously, I made the claim that the center of the universe is the pitcher's mound at Fenway. And the reason for that is because you've got BU sitting on one axis, you've got Harvard sitting on another axis, you've got MIT sitting on another axis, you've got BC sitting on another axis, you've got the Harvard Medical School sitting on another axis, and within about 3 to 5 mile radius of that pitcher's mound, you have an awful lot of what the new economy of the planet looks like. Now, if I had to pick one spot as the most interesting spot to sit today in the universe, known universe, because we just launched Kepler, which is one of the things happening over at the astrophysics area in Harvard, which is fascinating. It's a successor to Hubble, and it's going to go out and find all the exoplanets. And sometime over the next year, we will be full of exoplanets, some of which may or may not be Earth-like, but that's a separate topic. Of the known universe at this point, the corner of Vassar Street and Main Street may be the single most interesting corner anywhere. And the reason why is because you're sitting in the middle of a zip code, 02139, that has generated one of the largest economies on the planet in terms of the companies that the faculty and students that graduated from MIT have done. And the second reason is because you have a huge concentration of life science power bases that's come around the Whitehead and the Broad Institutes that did part of the research for the human genome. You have a new neurocognitive center, the PicoWare Institute, where they're bringing together into one building everybody who's thinking about the brain. So if you're a psychologist, if you're a psychiatrist, if you're a neurosurgeon, if you're a brain imager, if you're a computer scientist, anybody who's thinking about brains or circuitry or how this thing works are all talking to one another in a building, which is highly unusual for academia. And then right across the street from that, you've got a Frank Gehry building that has possibly the next generation of computing, the next generation of artificial intelligence, and the next generation of robotics. And you bring those three things together, and you think of single professors' labs generating market caps of $5 or $10 billion or $20 billion in the students that are graduating, the companies they found. You think of single professors' labs generating 5, 10, 15 startups per lab, and a lab is not a large place. You know, it's a, probably the size of most of our houses. And you think of the consequences of that, and you think of that brain power concentrated in one place. Boy, is this an interesting place to be sitting. And part of what happens when you walk around not just those three buildings, but within about 10 blocks of that corner, is you see hundreds of little companies. Some of them have gotten really big. I mean, some of them are absolutely massive, like Novartis or Dyax or Genzyme or Genentech or Merck over at the medical school. But a lot of them are companies that, you know, nobody had ever heard of 5 years ago that have all of a sudden gotten quite large. And then you've got the whole next generation of these things. Sometimes it's a single desk. Sometimes it's one office. And sometimes it's huge buildings that seem to come out of nowhere. It's just fascinating.
Who are the Norbert Wieners that the world will remember someday as fathers of this moment? And interesting people, interesting minds, regardless of the companies.
Depends how far back you want to go. I mean, the grandfather of everybody's Mendel and Darwin and Wallace, who I think hasn't gotten anywhere close to the credit he should get. And then you go through a whole series of people. You know, some of the people are folks people have never heard of. One of the most important people in this thing is a guy called Avery, who went out and found out that that DNA is the substance that really transmits heredity. And because he was modest and because he was careful, almost nobody's heard of this man outside the field, but I think he's as important as Watson and Crick. And then, of course, there's Watson and Crick, and then you get a lot of homegrown folks. You get Phil Sharp, you get Larry Gilbert, you get Eric Lander, you get just a whole host of smart people running around this place. Venter, I think, is a very smart guy. Lee Hood out in Washington is, you know, an absolutely brilliant systems thinker. And then there's a series of younger people. George Church isn't younger, but he's so exuberant that you think he's a lot younger than these guys. Church is just a magical elf, creating all kinds of wonderful things. You've got some of the folks at the Media Lab, Todd Machover doing his wonderful operas. You get some of the folks doing Siftables. You have Patty Mace coming up with the next generation of sort of a robotic camera BlackBerry combo. It's very hard to come up. You know, we could spend all day here talking about just these extraordinary minds. The people who built the web are running around Boston. The people who invented the mouse are running around Boston. The people who put together the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition that allows teenagers and college students to program cells from scratch are running around Boston. He lives in New Hampshire, but I'm still going to claim Dean Kamen because he's so smart and he's done so much in robotics.
It's Tim Berners-Lee's world, and we just happen to live in it. And there he is in an office no bigger than this at MIT. It is incredible. For most of them, though, Juan, it seems to me, unless they murdered their lab assistant, we would never hear them. They would never make the paper. How do we introduce them to our own neighborhood as extraordinarily powerful folk?
You know, I rarely like commercials, but last night I flopped down because I was tired in front of the TV, and I saw a commercial I actually liked, which is the new Intel commercial. And the reason why is because you have this, quasi-nerdy, probably Indian continent origin man, not particularly distinguished looking, walking through the hallway and people swooning and screaming and yelling almost like it was a rock concert with one of those teenage bands. And at the end, the punchline is, this is the man who invented that little device that allows you to transfer large amounts of files between one computer and the other, the USB key. And not all rock stars are created equal. This is our rock star, right? And boy, do we have a lot of those here. And we don't recognize them. You know, I think having programs like yours just do personal profiles of some of the most interesting people walking around here, because I finished a book last night which was fascinating called The Big Rich, about the four big Texas families and what happened over the course of one decade where they made huge fortunes as wildcatters in oil in Texas. There are very few times in history where that happens. That's happening in Boston right now. That's happening in Silicon Valley right now, and it's probably going to happen first in life sciences, then it's going to happen in robotics, then it's going to happen in nanotech, and then it's probably going to happen in the brain. There's going to be some overlap between those things, but some of these things are in the implementation stage, some of these are in the rollout the company stage, and some are still in the research phase. But that's where some of these heroes are going to come from, and that's where some of these big fortunes are going to come from. When you think of the next Intel's, Hewlett's, Microsoft's, Amazon's, eBay's, they're likely to be life science-based. I mean, there's still a couple of IT plays, big ones. But a lot of them are going to be in life sciences, and then a lot of them are going to be robotics. And then it's going to be a race between nanotech and the brain. But that's still, I think, 10, 15 years out.
Juan Enriquez, with your help, we're going to get to know some of these people. This is hugely interesting and, I suppose, I have to say, deeply encouraging, too. Thank you for an introduction.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.